good line either.
No, it cannot make distributions in cash or in kind. Right? It can, however, make services which would be below cost, and there are some questions that have been raised about nonprofits that then open the facilities which they operate to non-members, charge those members a higher amount than they make available to members, and whether there were problems with the statutory prohibition on nonprofit corporations, quote, making a profit. It's an area that is under reform. There is being circulated now a draft of revision of Alaska's nonprofit law by the Alaska Code Revision Commission. I would urge you to get a hold of it and look at it. It's got a commentary that is hopefully designed to explain the law in English rather than just plain legalese to people so that they can see what's going on. The law became subject of a major hearing in the state last year in which it was attacked with vigor by religious corporations on the ground that they didn't like the disclosure requirements that were put in the act, because for the first time you had to make disclosure to members and there was a greater disclosure obligation to the state. So that's basically where nonprofit laws are. One other way in which nonprofits have as a rule that differ from profit-seeking entities, generally when you vote in a corporation that is organized under the for-profit laws and you vote at the shareholder level, you vote not on the notion that one shareholder gets one vote, it's weighted voting. And so the shareholder who has the largest number of votes casts those shares. Shareholder who has an insignificant number of shares has a rather insignificant voice in what decisions are made. In nonprofit corporations, since they don't have shares, the idea is one member, one vote. And that is a basic political quality of the nonprofit that you'd want to be aware of and you'd want to look at. Now, what about co-ops? I indicated yesterday that the law on cooperatives in the state of Alaska is very, very, it's undeveloped area. We have two basic co-op statutes, Title 10, Section 15, Title 10, Section 25. 25 deals with what are called telephone and telegraphic cooperatives, and they're not under review at all. The other deals with all other cooperative ventures. It is under review. There is a working paper that has been prepared, which is a public document for the Code Revision Commission, which costs the state of Alaska money, and it belongs to every citizen of the state of Alaska if they'd like one, which talks about what the basics of co-ops are, what our statute looks like, analyzes it section by section, and gives you some basic views as to what the section is in terms of fitting in and how it would compare with a profit-seeking corporation and how it would differ from a nonprofit corporation. It is designed to give you a sort of bird's-eye view of what distinguishes cooperatives from other forms of enterprise. Cooperatives are corporations. This is a point that we must not lose sight of. Therefore, the assets of the cooperative are deemed to be the assets of the artificial legal entity called the corporation. They are not the personal assets of members. Members have no right to use those personal assets because other than as is permitted by the legal entity which they own together called a cooperative. So a cooperative has one basic area of attraction. It preserves a communal attitude toward assets as opposed to an individual attitude. There are individual rights, but they are within the context of this communal umbrella. And that is a very attractive feature and has been for the 300 and some odd years that cooperatives have been used for a variety of purposes among English-speaking people. Cooperatives were started as an attempt to gain economic self-sufficiency. Cooperatives were intended to be closed, not open societies. They were used and primarily have been used in this country by agricultural people. They had their greatest heyday in the United States in the upper tier states of the Midwest, states like the Dakotas, Wisconsin, Minnesota, had great experiences and have had 100-year experiences with cooperatives. The notion was that farmers would get together and they would try to control the circumstances under which they sold their grain. And those were called production co-ops. Their object was so that the farmers didn't sell as individuals but sold as a group, so that they could collectively bargain with buyers for better terms. Later on, cooperatives became, in addition to that, they said, well, we'll hold certain facilities which we need as in a community sense. So they would build grain elevators. They would build flour processors so that they could eliminate middlemen. They wouldn't have to go to local bankers to borrow money because they'd start savings institutions of their own. They wouldn't have to go to the local grain operator as a separate business person. They'd have their own grain elevator. And all of these things they would vend to themselves at cost. That's the key to a co-op, that its economic activities are theoretically done at cost to members. There's no profit motive within the co-op, but the co-op is organized to benefit its members, it's run by its members, and it tries to draw a wall around the activities of the co-op, and then it can deal as a very tough cookie with outsiders. But internally, the theory was that it worked by and for members. They did not allow shareholders. Shares were deemed to be in no way involved in co-ops. You were memberships. Later on, the idea of membership shares were set out when people wanted to have pieces of paper that were evidencing their status in the co-op. Memberships normally died with the member. I've heard it stated several times here that might be a desirable thing. Well, you can't inherit a membership in a co-op. It dies right along with the member and reverts to the co-op. Could they get investment from outside? If you want to go outside to get people to invest, how could you do it? Well, you could sell what was called capital stock to outsiders, to non-members, or members themselves could own capital stock. But the key to capital stock was capital stock couldn't vote. In other words, it could not participate in the control and management of the entity. If you had very economically important assets, you could, in effect, borrow money from capital stockholders by setting out a statement that you would pay them a certain fixed amount, and it was by contract or share indenture that you did that. And many cooperatives have that. The directors, however, of the co-op had to be members. The capital stockholders had classically no right to be represented on the board at all. And that was a very important idea. Later on, when the law was changed in certain states, so that co-ops began to allow non-member representatives of the capital shareholders onto the board, co-ops began to decline, because then the distinction between co-ops and any other type of corporate entity became blurred, and when it became blurred, there wasn't a vision to be captured anymore, and the thing began to wither and die. So the basic thing with co-ops is to recognize that in 1959, Alaska borrowed Oregon's statute, and we never gave it back. I mean, we've still got it. It is a bare-bones co-op statute enacted by a state which was never a big player in the world of cooperatives. I mean, Oregon was not a state in which there had been a lengthy political history with cooperatives. Right now, there are five states that one could look at to see what is right and wrong with cooperatives, how the experiments have run well or have tracked badly. You look at the acts of the Dakotas, you look at Wisconsin, you look at Minnesota, and more recently, you look at California, because co-ops have become very important in California, only they're growing as agricultural co-ops again, and consumer cooperatives are being added. But when you look at what is done in those states and look at what we have in Alaska, the biggest fear I would have as a counseling lawyer advising a client to form as a co-op is we have a very skeletal statute, a statute that shows the corrupting influences of many ideas that were sort of tried and failed, and it isn't cleaned up in any sense. And so before you start organizing or thinking seriously about co-ops, look carefully at what they are in potential legally. For instance, a classical way to protect a co-op is to say that it cannot merge, it cannot consolidate, and it cannot sell all of its assets to anything other than a co-op. And to protect your members by saying that those members automatically become members of the successor entity. Ironically, Alaska has no such protection. Alaska has a bizarre feature of its act which says that co-ops can merge or consolidate with profit-seeking corporations. So are they a good candidate to resist a takeover? No, they are not a good candidate to resist a takeover. Can you get the legislature to pass a co-op statute looking like the Wisconsin or Minnesota acts that have those carefully drawn provisions and protections built in? I'd say the political climate is ripe that you probably could. But you should have an interest. You have an ability here as citizens of Alaska to write the charter of what co-ops would be like and then, having influenced the formation of the law, make a decision. You don't have to go to Congress on that. The legislature itself has set up the study mechanism to look into it. And there'll be public hearings on this held. There had been a very useful AFN dialogue. Two of the attorneys who made the most significant contributions, Bart, Liz, are seated at the table. Similar instructions could be given to your attorneys to cooperate, and there are many people here who could cooperate in this co-op thing. Co-ops have a lot more to offer than I indicated yesterday, because I was warning you about what is, but it isn't necessarily what might be. Co-ops could become very useful, because the mentality of a cooperative is that it was an entity run by and for its members. It was a closed entity. There were restrictions on the transfer of co-op memberships are the rule. They're not the exception. You're not trying to go in and fight the battle as to whether or not you can justify these things. That's always been the norm, that you couldn't transfer the matter. And so co-ops do have, in a well-crafted statute that would answer your questions and not leave you open to a lot of doubt as to what your future would be, co-ops might well have a lot to offer.
Could I ask a question, Dan, just interrupting you? One of the things that people are concerned about here is that land, and we're talking about land being held by a co-op. Native corporation transfers its land to the co-op, and for the moment we're assuming it can do that without running into problems. The concern appears to be that land traditionally used communally should be passed on from generation to generation. So what about admitting to membership each succeeding generation? Can that be done through a co-op?
If the articles of the co-op, the articles of the co-op are where you define the qualifications and circumstances under which people become members, and you would sit down literally with a blank piece of paper and your idea, and you'd have no legal restrictions. Co-ops traditionally have been able to confer membership upon people because of their future participation in carrying out the collective endeavor of the co-op, rather than selling them a big share of stock. So a co-op in that sense would be very, very traditionally utilized for the purpose that you're envisioning.
Yes, Dolly, then Rosita.
I've worked some with fishermen co-ops, and one of the questions I have is what happens when a co-op goes defunct? Say the fishermen get discouraged because they're not able to influence the prices, the equipment that they bought is outdated. Can the co-op be dissolved?
Yes, the co-op can be dissolved, Dolly, but again, and this is the point that was made yesterday by several people here, Glenn among others, a co-op is no guarantee that there'll be a bright economic future. And the assets which the co-op has, to the extent they ever become obligated to third-party creditors, in the event the co-op is insolvent, can be reached by those third-party creditors. So, I mean, merely by saying that we will transfer our native lands and put it in the hands of a co-op, we are not assuring in any sense that those lands could never be subject to creditor claims. A co-op is not a panacea, but a co-op is a vehicle. That would look a lot more familiar as I'm beginning to get the picture of what the values of the culture are. A co-op would have been a far more familiar room to walk into than a corporate boardroom of a profit-seeking corporation. Many of the features of a co-op would have given you the impression that, gee, I've been here before. The furniture looks familiar. Co-ops have some interesting attributes.
But you're saying that closed membership and the and restrictions on transfer of membership.
And in a properly drafted statutory scheme, a way of preventing us from being taken over by some fundamentally different entity that becomes interested in our assets and comes along and says, here is a sweet deal for those of you who are alive. You sell us your stock and you'll live happily ever after, and zap, we've got it. You see, you can't sell memberships in a co-op.
And you can admit to membership succeeding generations without consideration.
Yes.
Yeah. Bart, you wanted to say something, and then
Dan,
Rosita.
Understanding that the statute is fairly narrow right now, on the side of accommodating individual interests and perhaps future economic development, what are the limitations in a co-op for making distributions, or the limitations in a co-op of creating funnel corporations or funnel businesses that they can give individual rights to, or else make monies out of in order to have some economic development of lands. I realize that the co-op had this purpose of delivering services. Is there the possibility of a co-op either in and of itself or through a group that it might form to have some kind of a profit motivation?
Co-ops were so far more intelligent than nonprofit corporations, which had to try and figure out, since they were, quote, forbidden to make profits, which has never been wholly true, how do you, as a business person planning, set your price schedule so that you won't drag in anything that might be called a profit? Co-ops go out and in their operations have no restrictions on making profits. But the essence was that at the end of the accounting period, the co-op would distribute the profit to the members. Now, you want to think about that. They have, just as nonprofit corporations are forbidden to make distributions, and profit-seeking corporations have the question of distributions to shareholders, yes or no, within the business judgment of the directors, co-ops were legally obligated to make the distributions. But that was of net profits. And I mean, if you had taken money out and invested it by buying another fishing boat, or you'd invested it in by building a grain elevator, then co-ops could increase and expand their economic base. They didn't have to just pay all the money out to individuals as members. So there was a lot of flexibility. But no, they are under the general legal prescription that anything which is net of their business expenses represent profits, and profits go to members. That's what a co-op was all about.
Subsidiaries?
Alaska statute would be silent on the question. So we could sit down with a blank piece of paper and draft that.
I ask you that because I want to know about the typical reason for using child corporations or subsidiaries is to reduce the element of risk with regard to a certain amount of assets that you want to set out. So if you have a co-op, you've got all your subsistence lands, but you identify the 100 acres down on the river, you want to make an industrial development, but you only want to risk that 100 acres. That would be the place where you'd want to make a subsidiary.
Surely, and there should be nothing to prohibit you from doing that, and then you enter into contractual relationships between the two cooperatives.
Could I ask a question? We're spawning new legal entities like mad here, and it's but there are the let's suppose the village corporations wanted to think seriously about turning their subsistence land over to a cooperative. That seems to be what many people have in mind, or to a nonprofit or an IRA or whatever, but let's say cooperative. Now, Bart just asked you, well, if there's a risk-taking activity, a business activity that can be undertaken on the land, can you turn that over to a subsidiary? Well, you've already got existing corporate structures out there, for-profit corporations all over the place. The landscape is I won't say littered, but loaded with them. And can the cooperative then make the same arrangement with an existing for-profit village corporation that it could with a subsidiary in the way that you just discussed with Bart?
It wouldn't be so clear under existing Alaska law because our statute is silent on the relationship of cooperatives.
I see.
Right? But the fact that the statute would currently permit cooperatives to merge or consolidate with profit-seeking corporations, which I think is an extremely dangerous idea and is out of sync with the better-drawn statutes in sister states. But that as you revisit that, there would be nothing to prohibit you from saying that they could enter into contractual relationships with such entities. I mean, I want you to understand that from my perspective, and I was characterized yesterday by Claude as a person who was a complete outsider, and I perfectly accept the characterization. It sounds to me like the cooperative, in many of the things I have listened to, is better suited to be the village corporation than merely the residual entity to which the village corporation has tried to convey the mm-hmm. village lands. That people would be happier and existing in the cooperative, that it does not exacerbate the mine and vine dichotomy, that instead things are regarded as ours and imposes less of an institutional challenge to traditional values. But I mean, that's the
well,
perception of
yeah,
a person who's got a 2-day-old notice of traditional values, you know.
Right. Well, let Rosita, you wanted to add something.
I have a question, and I think Tony raised it some the first day, and that is, well, Native communities are also interested in continuing their federal trust relationship. And we noted that corporations are whatever tribal organizations and or tribal entities in that they could contract for services or government programs under 93638. And the question is not where the trust relationship extends through corporations, but it does seem that it would be important for the corporation, for communities to maintain this a corporation, or unless there was an amendment, I guess a congressional amendment that transferred whatever rights or recognitions that corporations have as a Native entity. It would have to be a congressional amendment to make the cooperatives that new entity. If it didn't happen, I would. It would seem that we would have to have maintain the corporations for the purposes of 93638, and then there might also, and this is the problem I think that communities are having, is that they have so many different organizational entities in the villages to protect, you know, relationships, federal relationships, and then to do the kind of businesses that they want to do. So it would seem we might have corporations, we might have IRAs, we would have city councils, and then we would also have cooperatives. Now, the question is, I guess it would take a congressional.
David Case?
Well, and I'm sure, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that a profit-making corporation can convert itself into a cooperative by a two-thirds shareholders vote amending the articles.
I mean, what we'd do is we'd set up we'd incorporate a cooperative. Cooperative is a corporation, and then you would merge the existing village corporation into the cooperative corporation. So in a merger, you begin with Corporation A and Corporation B, and only one of them is destined to survive. And that would become the cooperative.
But
it wouldn't necessarily add to the landscape. It could change it.
The current statute in Alaska, I believe, permits a profit-making corporation to amend its articles and become a cooperative simply by amending its articles of incorporation.
It may well.
Without the merger.
There is so much flexibility incumbent in current Alaska law as to be frightening.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I'm not sure that's a good idea or a bad idea,
yeah.
But it seems to be possible to convert the profit corporation, as things now stand, into a cooperative without dissenters' rights and through a vote of the shareholders.
One thing that I want to point out to you is that cooperatives are also managed by a board of directors, and that since they're like a corporation. One of the things that is very useful is in a cooperative that only members can be directors. That can be a useful thing and a non-useful thing if you want to bring somebody in for their expertise. There can be officers of the cooperative who are not members, and that the directors of cooperatives and nonprofits have the same fiduciary obligations, and they would have the same conflict of interest questions that are related to your existing profit-seeking board.
Yes. Could I ask David to answer your question, Rosita?
But it doesn't get to you. I mean, that doesn't, saying that it is, and I think that's correct. I mean, but that comes from just reading this fairly brief provision of the cooperative statutes, which I was surprised to see. But
well, what about Rosita's point?
Right, it doesn't get away from the problem of creating new institutions, and I think that's a very good point you make about the present definitions in federal law, which may come into question if you no longer have a village corporation or a tribal government, and then you don't have the Self-Determination Act clearly applicable to the new organization. So what you've got, as you suggest, is many organizations sticking around for different purposes, and it would be better probably to have them consolidated.
Dolly and then Tony.
When you were initially talking about corporations and their potential for changing to a cooperative, you had mentioned the fear, and I thought you were suggesting that it was the counseling lawyers themselves. But I have two questions. One is, if if a corporation, say, develops a cooperative for the purpose of putting the land in a separate entity, and then the corporation decides 5 years down the line that they want that land back, can they get it back?
No. If the land was somehow transferred to and became, in the eyes of the law, the legal property of the cooperative, then it would require a reconveyance from the cooperative to the corporation. Now, if you're talking about the same human beings being the beneficial owners of both the corporation and the cooperative, that ought not to pose a problem. But if you ever have two different sets of equitable owners, then for the first time you're going to have a genuine problem.
Okay, the second question is, say that the corporations decide to change to a cooperative. Under a cooperative, will that body be required to distribute all of the profits annually, or can they maintain some of it for future investments?
That is an important question, and there had been cases in the United States in the 19th century that suggested that if you hadn't committed the, quote, profits, that they were then to be distributed. The better reason cases, and you could handle this by having the statute define what the distribution obligation of the cooperative is, all right, is that they should obviously be allowed to maintain reserves for planning. And what I'm trying to say is that the existing directors, by making plans for the business expenditure of what would otherwise be cooperative receipts, can convert them out of being regarded as, quote, profits that you then have to turn around and distribute. But you begin with an idea that in a profit-seeking corporation, it's purely the business judgment of the directors as to whether they'll ever distribute any of the profits. In a nonprofit corporation, you lock yourself into a setting where you're not supposed to distribute any. In a cooperative, you are supposed to distribute all net profits, but there's a lot of manipulation that can go on as to what is ascertained to be a net profit.
Flexibility, I believe.
Flexibility.
The word that you were searching for.
Flexibility, my counsel tells me, is the word that I should have been searching for. Yeah.
Tony, and then Glenn.
Thank you. The one question I wanted to pose on the backdrop of cooperatives is something that was just discussed a little bit earlier, and that is say a cooperative has been set up by a village corporation, and they have a tremendous amount of pressure on them to have some personal use of a land like the Shanseed has taken. How would that fit within the rubric of a cooperative?
A cooperative can make distributions to its members in kind, and it can also make distributions in partial liquidation.
Can it, at the same time, use the land for? I mean, can they allow members to use the land without making a distribution to that land to the member?
I would assume that they could, and it would be wise. I don't think I've ever read a cooperative statute that is clear on that, because you understand that the traditional cooperative was talking about farmlands, and the farms were generally owned by the individual farmers who then joined the co-op. And so the co-op was an amalgamation of property that was individually owned. We're coming from the opposite perspective. We're coming from a communal asset that will be placed under the thing. And it would be wise for the statute to make it very clear that it could.
Mm-hmm. The
point I keep wanting to say is that there's an obvious tendency in some members of this group, and it may be absolutely necessary, to favor making arrangements with the federal government as the best way to go about resolving the problems which you're now beginning to experience. And that may ultimately have to be done. But I'm saying don't overlook the possibility that there may already be within your hands tools that you can use to fashion solutions that are more to your liking or more to your utility or benefit that do not require you to go to the federal government. And in this instance, with a cooperative statute that is already on a legislative agenda for reform, that's being written on a blank piece of paper by individuals whose interest is in trying to do what's best for Alaska, you have an opportunity to design the erector set. And at least to participate in that. There's very little vested interest about cooperatives right now, and it's a useful thing.
I think Glenn and then Dolly.
I was going to ask on dissenters' rights. If we were to change over, do the dissenters then would stop the process, or are there dissenters' rights in the co-op?
Alaska statute's totally silent on the topic, and one of the things you fear is there's also a provision that says to the extent that they're compatible with for-profit corporations, any holes in this bare-bones statute are to be filled in by a reference to the profit-seeking corporation, and so...
We'd have to write it in. I think that's...
Yeah.
Are there any dissenters' rights in that question?
Yeah. No.
No. I think you
meant if you're in a cooperative and the cooperative goes through an organic change, are there dissenters' rights?
I thought your question was if you change from the corporate form to the cooperative form, are you stuck with the dissenters' rights at that point?
That's right.
Yeah, and you may well be. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. if you go about it by a merger of the existing corporation with the other, the question which Glenn posed, is there a way to sort of transmute the for-profit corporation into a cooperative corporation and not say that you ever engaged in a merger or consolidation, and that I'm not sure of.
I think dissenters' rights is something we have to return to, Glenn,
yeah.
And I think it's an important subject, and Elizabeth spoke very forcefully yesterday to the effect that it just couldn't be dismissed, and I think we should return to it. But maybe that's something we should return to along with the whole question of soliciting proxies, because that's all tied up with it. And perhaps we could return to that this afternoon and spend the morning on these various entities that once they're holding the land, well, if you've gone through all that agony, what have you got? And I think that's what we're struggling with now. Elizabeth and then David and then Dolly, sorry.
At risk of being shot, I would like to say one thing about a corporation, which is, I was wondering, as I've been listening to the discussion this morning, I would like to just pose something, throw it out, and not particularly have it commented about, but just have you think about it. I would like to assume, for purposes of my hypothetical, which does not involve a village corporation, that we were successful in going to Congress and getting some mechanism for a continuation of restricted stock. Okay, I just like to assume that in my example. And I was wondering about the possibility of retaining, in instances where the land has the bulk of it, or that a very important use of this surface land was related to the subsistence purpose and goal, of leaving that in what I would refer to as the parent corporation, which already has all of the rights and indices that Rosita referred to as to the status in terms of the tribal status and this type of thing, and also already has tied to it the options of the land bank protections, and transfer over into the subsidiaries the four, what we would traditionally think of the four profit activities, the things that Glenn's Village Corporation has that are like the real property in Anchorage for making money and these kinds of things. If you did, so many times when people have talked about these transfers, they keep talking about transferring the land. And if you transferred the land into a subsidiary posture, indeed it could be taken if you had business risks and losses at the parent level. But if you kept the land at the parent level and took your risk-making activities and put them in the subsidiary and then did your right corporate veils between, your land would be protected from the losses at the for-profit level. Now,
sorry, what in between? Did you say corporate veils? That
corporate veil,
oh,
yes.
Oh, right, okay.
Okay. So I just want to suggest that even within the corporate format, there are ways to move things around. But I understand that for purposes of discussion, I have assumed restricted stock at the parent level.
I think you are right to insist that we consider the whole range of possibilities, although it seems regrettable we were making so much headway.
It was a footnote, only a footnote.
I'm sorry, who, Dolly and then Roland?
I still have one question on the net profits. Under a cooperative, let me start again.
With the corporation, the board members determine the dividends in Southeast there somewhat annually for several of the village corporations, and the board members look at what the investment potential is for the next year and then try to see how much money we've got and then make a dividend with what we feel we can. Under a cooperative, would there be greater influence by the membership in saying, listen, we really don't like your investment potential and we want all of the net profits to come to us and we don't want you investing further? My concern is that there are shareholders or potential members who are not interested in economic development. They're interested in a dividend and the largest possible dividend.
The directors of a cooperative are elected by the members and from the ranks of membership. So if you had a political division in the ranks of your members wherein a majority of the people favored the notion of not saving but distributing to individuals, then a cooperative would be a device wherein you would be making no investments and you would be making short-term distributions. That, of course, is possible in a profit-seeking corporation as well if you lose the majority constituency to people who want to elect directors who favor maximum dividend policies as opposed to the retention of earnings. But you're absolutely right to be concerned that one characteristic of the cooperative is a bias in favor of distributions, and that is not a bias or an inertia that is built into the basic notion of a profit-seeking corporation. Mm-hmm. Because the notion of the reason there's a bias in favor of distributions in cooperatives is because it's our money, and we are the members, and we are the cooperative, and there are no third parties. The reason there is no such bias within the notion of a profit-seeking corporation is because the shareholders in large corporations such as General Motors are generally not the people who work for the corporation. They're not the people who consume its products. They're the people who put money at its disposal for their own private purposes. And the idea is that they're, quote, owners too, but in a much more restricted and distant past and or theory, and that they should not have the same right to insist upon dividends. There's no right to insist upon dividends in a corporation, just equal treatment if the board in its business discretion decides that there shall be. In a cooperative, you begin with the assumption that there is an annual obligation to yield over to the members as theirs any net profits, but that again, you could design a statute in such a manner in Juneau, not Washington, D.C., that would reach a reasonable accommodation on that ground.
Could I just suggest that how we manage our timetable, I'll come to Bart next, but before lunch, I'd like Ralph to talk about IRAs. Then we can come back and muse about all.
Can you ask for waivers so that Ralph could do that?
Yeah, I said before lunch. Yeah. Okay,
I'll wait. Go.
All right. Bart will waive. And then after lunch, we'll talk about getting them from A to B and the problem of soliciting proxies and so on. All right, Ralph, you're by popular demand.
I should say that I won't be as extensive about IRAs because many of you know much more about them than all of us know about co-ops. And it's been very instructive to hear so much more background about co-ops. Nonetheless, there are certain attributes of IRAs that are especially significant here. As I understand from David Case, there are about 71 IRAs in Alaska. There are, in addition, a number, and I don't know the number, of traditional governments that are recognized, and of course there are quite a number of traditional governments that are not recognized. Whether that recognition is key, I'd rather deal only with those that are officially recognized at the moment. Most of what I say about IRAs will also apply to traditionals. At the present time, it seems clear from what's been said that the village or regional corporations could transfer their assets to an IRA, and I suppose in most cases we're talking about a transfer of assets from a village corporation. Now, first thing to realize is that this is a transfer of land that is held under ANCSA. It would not automatically put the land back in trust. That may or may not be desirable. I'm simply stating a fact that the transfer of the land to an IRA would not automatically put it back in trust, and the current secretary, the current administration, has generally taken the position that they will not accept ANCSA land back in trust. If it were put back in trust, then that sets up a whole different set of attributes of that ownership. It makes it clear that it's not subject to state taxation, makes it clear that the federal government has a legal obligation to manage that trust, and some other things. But right now, I'm only concerned about land that would be transferred to an IRA, still under the ANCSA rules, and not going back into a trust status. Now, one of the most important things that I'll be talking about is the fact of sovereign immunity. And sovereign immunity is one of those oddities that we've all talked about, but three sentences about it. It comes from an old English concept. It's not in the Constitution of the United States. It's a common law concept that was brought here from England. It applies to protect the federal government, the state government, and tribal governments from any suit unless those governments consent to the suit. It has grown in great disfavor in recent years in the United States. There are many, many, many statutory and judicial, essentially, waivers of sovereign immunity in the federal and state arena. But it is a concept which is still very much alive. It does serve as a tool for the IRAs if they wish to use it. The IRA is usually divided into two entities. One is the governmental side, the other is the corporate side, under the 1936 amendment of the Alaska IRA. I assume that the land that we're talking about transferring would be transferred from the village corporation to the governmental side of the IRA. If it were transferred to the corporate side of the IRA, then there probably is no sovereign immunity, because generally there is a waiver of sovereign immunity called a sue and be sued clause that exists in the corporate side of the IRA. Now, if it was, it now has been transferred to the IRA, to the government side of the IRA, and that government side has not waived its sovereign immunity. A PS to that, an important PS. Cases decided since 1980 indicate that the government of the IRA can waive its own sovereign immunity. Prior to 1980, 1981, it was widely believed that only Congress could waive an IRA's sovereign immunity. I should say the same thing about a traditional government, that since 1980, 81, it seems clear, a case in the Ninth Circuit and some language in the U.S. Supreme Court opinions, that the government can itself waive its sovereign immunity if it wishes to do so. It can waive that sovereign immunity in a special case with regard to a specific piece of land or a specific transaction, or it can waive its sovereign immunity generally. That's the option of the IRA government to do that. It's within its choice. Now, do state taxes apply to the land that is now owned by the IRA government? The answer is yes, they apply, but the state can't get at it because they can't sue the tribe. Sovereign immunity. They're stopped. They can't sue the tribe, either an IRA or a traditional tribe, unless that sovereign immunity is waived. I'll beg off on one other aspect of that. States have become increasingly aggressive about pursuing land that is not in trust on reservations or in Indian country, and it's conceivable that they could pursue the land in a special kind of action, a suit against the land itself, called an in rem action, but a suit against the land itself, not sue the tribe. I can't answer you as to whether the state could get at the land that way. I don't know of any cases in the United States which have permitted it, but at least that is an outside possibility. Can the tribal government, IRA or otherwise, voluntarily convey the land? And the answer is almost surely no, and that's because of statutes that started called the Non-Intercourse Acts, which started in 1790 and have been reaffirmed and are still very much alive, that an Indian tribe, IRA or traditional, cannot convey land without the consent of the United States. It's whether or not it's held in trust. It simply cannot convey the land unless there is also consent by the United States. Now, the solicitor, Clyde March, in 1981, said that's not true. I think that Bart Garber and David Case and I all agree that the solicitor is wrong. But you should realize that the solicitor is a former friend of mine before he decided that. He was a law professor before that and some other things. But in any event, that particular solicitor decided that the tribe could convey land aside or outside the limitation of the Non-Intercourse Act. There's no judicial determination of that question yet.
The solicitor might conceivably, or it is not inconceivable that he is right.
It's not inconceivable that he's right. That's right. No, it's. Yeah, it's inconceivable. In any way, we'll just leave the disagreement where it lies. We have 3-1 here against him. Bankruptcy. The IRA government cannot go bankrupt. It'll continue on. It may incur far more debts than it has assets, but it's not subject to going under, so to speak. It may have trouble getting money, but it's not going to go through bankruptcy. Takeovers. There's no way that an IRA government can be taken over. It's chartered under federal law, and there's no way under federal law it can be taken over. It's a sovereign government. It has attributes of sovereignty. The same thing is true of a traditional government, whether recognized or not. There's no takeover possibility for that. The members control it. Fractionalization. If the land is in a, this is the problem that we were talking about this morning in various contexts, it would eliminate the problem of fractionalization because membership in the IRA is determined by Indianness or nativeness, however the definition of that IRA is set up, your quarter blood or